Let me give you the layout. Me sitting at the table. On my left, the newspaper. On my right, the cup of coffee. In the middle of the table, the packet of biscuits. I see it perfectly, said Fenchurch. What you don't see, said Arthur, because I haven't mentioned him yet, is the guy sitting at the table already. He's sitting there opposite me. What's he like? Oh, perfectly ordinary. Briefcase, business suit. He didn't look, said Arthur, as if he was about to do anything weird. Ah, I know the type. What did he do? He did this. He leaned across the table, picked up the packet of biscuits, tore it open, took one out, and... What? Ate it. What? He ate it. Fenchurch looked at him in astonishment. What on earth did you do? Well, in the circumstances, I did what any red-blooded Englishman would do. I was compelled, said Arthur, to ignore it. What? Why? Well, it's not the sort of thing you're trained for, is it? I searched my soul and discovered there was nothing anywhere in my upbringing, experience, or even primal instincts to tell me how to react to someone who has quite simply, calmly, sitting right there in front of me, stolen one of my biscuits. Well, you could... Fenchurch thought about it. I must say I'm not sure what I would have done either. So what happened? I stared furiously at the crossword, said Arthur. Couldn't do a single clue, took a sip of coffee, it was too hot to drink, so there was nothing for it. I braced myself, I took a biscuit, trying very hard not to notice. He added that the packet was already mysteriously open. But you're fighting back, taking a tough line. After my fashion, yes. I ate the biscuit. I ate it very deliberately and visibly, so that he would have no doubt as to what it was I was doing. When I eat a biscuit, Arthur said, it stays eaten. So what did he do? Took another one. Honestly, insisted Arthur. This is exactly what happened. He took another biscuit. He ate it. Clear as daylight. Certain as we are sitting on the ground. Fenchurch stirred uncomfortably. And the problem was, said Arthur, that having not said anything the first time, it was somehow even more difficult to broach the subject the second time around. I mean, what do you say? Excuse me, I couldn't help noticing. It doesn't work. No, I ignored it, if anything with more vigour than previously. My man, said Fenchurch. Stared at the crossword again, still couldn't budge a bit of it, so showing some of the spirit that Henry V did on St. Crispin's Day. What? I went into the breach again. I took, said Arthur, another biscuit, and for an instant our eyes met. Like this? Yes, well, no, not quite like that, but they met, just for an instant, and we both looked away. But I am here to tell you, said Arthur, there was a little electricity in the air. There was a little tension building up over the table at about this time. I can imagine. We went through the whole packet like this. Him, me. The whole packet, said Fenchurch. Well, it was only 8 biscuits, but it seemed like a lifetime of biscuits we were getting through at this point. Gladiators could hardly have had a tougher time. Gladiators, said Fenchurch, would have had to do it in the sun, more physically gruelling. There is that. So, when the empty packet was lying dead between us, the man at last got up, having done his worst, and left. I heaved a sigh of relief, of course. As it happened, my train was announced a moment or two later, so I finished my coffee, stood up, picked up the newspaper, and underneath the newspaper, yes, were my biscuits. What, said Fenchurch? What? True. No! She gasped and tossed herself back on the grass, laughing. She sat up again. You complete nitwit, she hooted. You almost completely and utterly foolish person. She pushed him backwards, rolled over him, kissed him, and rolled off again. He was surprised at how light she was. "Now you tell me a story," said Arthur. "I thought," she said, putting on a low, husky voice, "that you were very keen to get back." "No hurry," he said airily. "I want you to tell me a story." She looked out over the lake and pondered. "All right," she said. "It's only a short one and not funny like yours, but, anyway." She looked down. Arthur could feel that it was one of those sorts of moments. The air seemed to stand still around them, waiting. Arthur wished that the air would go away and mind its own business. "When I was a kid," she said. These stories always start like this, don't they? "When I was a kid. Anyway, this is the bit where the girl suddenly goes, 'When I was a kid,' and starts to unburden herself. We have got to that bit. When I was a kid, I had this picture hanging over the foot of my bed. What do you think of it so far?" "I like it," said Arthur. "I think it's moving well. You're getting the bedroom interest in nice and early. We could probably do some development with the picture." "It was one of those pictures that children are supposed to like," she said, "but don't. Full of endearing little animals doing endearing things, you know?" "I know, I was plagued with them too. Rabbits in waistcoats." "Exactly. These rabbits were in fact on a raft, just where assorted rats and owls. There may even have been a reindeer." "On the raft?" "On the raft. And a boy was sitting on the raft." "Among the rabbits in waistcoats and owls and the reindeer," said Arthur. "Precisely there. a boy of the cheery, gypsy ragamuffin variety. Ugh. The picture worried me, I must say. There was an otter swimming in front of the raft, and I used to lie awake at night worrying about this otter having to pull the raft with all those wretched animals on it, who shouldn't even be on a raft, and the otter had such a thin tail to pull it with, I thought it must hurt pulling it all the time. Worried me, not badly, but just vaguely, all the time. Then one day, and remember I'd been looking at this picture every night for years, I suddenly noticed that the raft had a sail. Never seen it before. The otter was fine. He was just swimming along. She shrugged. Good story, she said. Ends weakly, said Arthur. Leaves the audience crying, yes, but what of it? Fine up till there, but it needs a final sting before the credits. Fenchurch laughed and hugged her legs. It was just such a sudden revelation. Years of almost unnoticed worry just dropping away, like taking off heavy weights, like black and white becoming colour, like a dry stick suddenly being watered. The sudden shift of perspective that says, put away your worries, the world is a good and perfect place. It is, in fact, very easy. You probably think I'm saying that because I'm going to say I felt like that this afternoon or something, don't you? Well, I... said Arthur, his composure suddenly shattered. Well, it's all right, she said. I did. That's exactly what I felt. But, you see, I felt that before, even stronger, incredibly strongly. I'm afraid I'm a bit of a one, she said, gazing off into the distance for sudden, startling revelations. Arthur was at sea, could hardly speak, and felt it wiser, therefore, for the moment not to try. It was very odd, she said, much as one of the pursuing Egyptians might have said that the behaviour of the Red Sea when Moses waved his rod at it was a little on the strange side. Very odd, she repeated. For days before, the strangest feeling had been building in me, as if I was going to give birth. And no, it wasn't like that, in fact. It was more as if I was being connected into something, bit by bit. Not even that. It was as if the whole of the earth, through me, was going to... Does the number, said Arthur gently, 42, mean anything to you? What? Now, what are you talking about? Exclaimed Fenchurch. Just a thought, murmured Arthur. Arthur, I mean this. This is very real to me. This is serious. I was being perfectly serious, said Arthur. It's just the universe I'm never quite sure about. What do you mean by that? Tell me the rest of it, he said. Don't worry if it sounds odd. Believe me, you are talking to someone who has seen a lot of stuff, he added, that is odd. And I don't mean biscuits. She nodded and seemed to believe him. Suddenly she gripped his arm. It was so simple, she said, so wonderfully and extraordinarily simple when it came. What was it? Said Arthur quietly. Arthur, you see, she said, that's what I no longer know, and the loss is unbearable. If I try to think back to it, it all just goes flickery and jumpy, and if I try too hard, I get as far as the teacup and I just black out. What? Well, like your story, she said, the best bit happened in a cafe. I was sitting there having a cup of tea. This was after days of this build-up, the feeling of becoming connected up. I think I was buzzing gently. And there was some work going on at a building site opposite the cafe, and I was watching it through the window over the rim of my teacup, which I always find is the nicest way of watching other people working. And suddenly, there it was in my mind, this message from somewhere. And it was so simple. It made such sense of everything. I just sat up and thought, oh, oh, well, that's all right then. I was so startled I almost dropped my teacup. In fact, I think I did drop it. Yes, she added thoughtfully. I'm sure I did. How much sense am I making? It was fine up to the bit about the teacup. She shook her head and shook it again as if trying to clear it, which is what she was trying to do. Well, that's it, she said. Fine up to the bit about the teacup. That was the point at which it seemed to me quite literally as if the world exploded. What? I know it sounds crazy and everybody says it was hallucinations, but if that was hallucinations, then I have hallucinations in big screen 3D with 16-track Dolby Stereo and should probably hire myself out to people who are bored of shark movies. It was as if the ground was literally ripped from under my feet and... She patted the grass lightly as if for reassurance and then seemed to change her mind about what she was going to say. And I woke up in hospital. I suppose I've been in and out ever since. And that's why I have an instinctive nervousness, she said, of sudden, startling revelations that everything's going to be all right. She looked up at him. Arthur had simply ceased to worry himself about the strange anomalies surrounding his return to his home world, or rather had consigned them to that part of his mind marked things to think about, urgent. Here is the world, he had told himself. Here, for whatever reason, is the world, and here it stays, with me on it. But now it seemed to go swimmy around him, as it had that night in the car when Fenchurch's brother had told him the silly stories of the CIA agent in the reservoir. The French embassy went swimmy, the trees went swimmy, the lake went swimmy, but this was perfectly natural and nothing to be alarmed by because a grey goose had just landed on it. The geese were having a great relaxed time and had no major answers they wished to know the questions to. Anyway, said Fenchurch suddenly and brightly with a wide-eyed smile, there is something wrong with part of me, and you've got to find out what it is. We'll go home. Arthur shook his head. What's the matter? She said. Arthur had shaken his head not to disagree with her suggestion, which he thought was a truly excellent one, one of the world's great suggestions, but because he was just for a moment trying to free himself of the recurring impression he had that just when he was least expecting it, the universe would suddenly leap out from behind a door and go boo at him. I'm just trying to get this entirely clear in my mind, said Arthur. You say you felt as if the earth actually exploded. Yes, said Fenchurch, more than felt. Which is what everybody says, he said hesitantly, is hallucinations. Yes, but Arthur, that's ridiculous. People think if you just say hallucinations, it explains anything you want it to explain, and eventually whatever it is you can't understand will just go away. It's just a word. It doesn't explain anything. It doesn't explain why the dolphins disappeared. No, said Arthur. No, he added thoughtfully. No, he added again, even more thoughtfully. What? He said at last. It doesn't explain the dolphins disappearing. No, said Arthur. I see that. Which dolphins do you mean? What do you mean, which dolphins? I'm talking about when all the dolphins disappeared. She put her hand on his knee, which made him realize that the tingling going up and down his spine was not her gently stroking his back, and must instead be one of those nasty, creepy feelings he so often got when people were trying to explain things to him. The dolphins? Yes. All the dolphins, said Arthur, disappeared. Yes. The dolphins? You're saying that the dolphins all disappeared. Is this, said Arthur, trying to be absolutely clear on this point, what you're saying? Arthur, where have you been, for heaven's sake? The dolphins all disappeared on the same day I... She stared him intently in his startled eyes. What? No dolphins. All gone. Vanished. She searched his face. Did you really not know that? It was clear from his startled expression that he did not. Where did they go? He asked. No one knows. That's what vanished means. She paused. Well, there is one man who says he knows about it, but everyone says he lives in California, she said, and is mad. I was thinking of going to see him because he seems the only lead I've got on what happened to me. She shrugged and then looked at him long and quietly. She laid her hand on the side of his face. I really would like to know where you've been, she said. I think something terrible happened to you then as well, and that's why we recognized each other. She glanced around the park, which is now being gathered into the clutches of dusk. Well, she said, now you've got someone you can tell. Arthur slowly let out a long year of a sigh. It is, he said, a very long story. Fenchurch leaned across him and drew over her canvas bag. Is it anything to do with this? She said. The thing she took out of her bag was battered and travel-worn, as it had been hurled into prehistoric rivers, baked under the sun that shines so redly on the deserts of Cacrifoon, half buried in the marbled sands that fringe the heady vapoured oceans of Santragenus V, frozen on the glaciers of the moon of Jaglan Beta, sat on, kicked around spaceships, scuffed and generally abused, and since its makers had thought that these were exactly the sorts of things that might happen to it, they had thoughtfully encased it in a sturdy plastic cover and written on it, in large friendly letters, the words, Don't Panic. Where did you get this? Said Arthur, startled, taking it from her. Ah, she said, I thought it was yours. In Russell's car that night, you dropped it. Have you been to many of these places? Arthur drew the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy from its cover. It was like a small, thin, flexible lap computer. He tapped some buttons till the screen flared with text. A few, he said. Can we go to them? What? No, said Arthur abruptly, then relented, but relented warily. Do you want to? He said, hoping for the answer no. It was an act of great generosity on his part not to say, you don't want to, do you? Which expects it. Yes, she said. I want to know what the message was that I lost and where it came from. Because I don't think, she added, standing up and looking around the increasing gloom of the park, that it came from here. I'm not even sure, she further added, slipping her arm around Arthur's waist, that I know where here is. Chapter 21. The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy is, as has been remarked before, often and accurately, a pretty startling kind of a thing. It is essentially, as the title implies, a guidebook. The problem is, or rather one of the problems, for there are many, a sizable proportion of which are continually clogging up the civil, commercial, and criminal courts in all areas of the galaxy, and especially, where possible, the more corrupt ones, this. The previous sentence makes sense. That is not the problem. This is. Change. Read it through again and you'll get it. The galaxy is a rapidly changing place. There is, frankly, so much of it, every bit of which is continually on the move, continually changing. A bit of a nightmare, you might think, for a scrupulous and conscientious editor diligently striving to keep this massively detailed and complex electronic tome abreast of all the changing circumstances and conditions that the galaxy throws up every minute of every hour of every day, and you would be wrong. Where you would be wrong would be in failing to realise that the editor, like all the editors the Guide has ever had, has no real grasp of the meanings of the words scrupulous, conscientious, or diligent, and tends to get his nightmares through a straw. Entries tend to get updated or not across the sub-Ethernet, according to if they read good. Take, for example, the case of Brequinda on the Foth of Avalars, famed in myth, legend, and stultifyingly dull tri-D miniseries as the home of the magnificent and magical Fualornis Fire Dragon. In ancient days, before the advent of the Sorth of Braggadox, when Fragilis sang, and Saxoquin of the Quenilux held sway, when the air was sweet and the nights fragrant, but everyone somehow managed to be, or so they claimed, though how on earth they could have thought that anyone was even remotely likely to believe such a preposterous claim, what with all the sweet air and fragrant nights and whatnot, is anyone's guess, virgins, it was not possible to heave a brick on Brequinda in the Foth of Avalars without hitting at least half a dozen Fualornis fire dragons. Whether you would want to do that is another matter. Not that fire dragons weren't an essentially peace-loving species, because they were. They adored it to bits, and this wholesale adoring of things to bits was often in itself the problem. One so often hurts the one loves, especially if one is a Fualornis fire dragon with breath like a rocket booster and teeth like a park fence. Another problem was that once they were in the mood, they often went on to hurt quite a lot of the ones that other people loved as well. Add to all that the relatively small number of madmen who actually went around the place heaving bricks, and you end up with quite a lot of people on Brequinda and the Foth of Avalars getting seriously hurt by dragons. But did they mind? They did not. Were they heard to bemoan their fate? No. The Fualornis fire dragons were revered throughout the lands of Brequinda and the Foth of Avalars for their savage beauty, their noble ways, and their habit of biting people who didn't revere them. Why was this? The answer was simple. Sex. There is, for some unfathomed reason, something almost unbearably sexy about having huge, fire-breathing, magical dragons flying low about the sky on moonlit nights, which were already dangerously on the sweet and fragrant side. Why this should be so, the romance-besotted people of Brequinda and the Foth of Avalars could not have told you, and would not have stopped to discuss the matter once the effect was up and going, for no sooner would a flock of half a dozen silk-winged, leather-bodied Fualornis fire dragons heave into sight across the evening horizon than half the people of Brequinda are scurrying off into the woods with the other half, there to spend a busy, breathless night together, and emerge with the first rays of dawn, all smiling and happy, and still claiming, rather endearingly, to be virgins, if rather flushed and sticky virgins. Pheromones, some researchers said. Something sonic, others claimed. The place was always stiff with researchers trying to get to the bottom of it all, and taking a very long time about it. Not surprisingly, the guide's graphically enticing description of the general state of affairs on this planet has proved to be astonishingly popular amongst hitchhikers who allow themselves to be guided by it, and so it has simply never been taken out. And it is therefore left to latter-day travellers to find out for themselves that today's modern Requinda and the city-state of Avalars is now little more than concrete, strip joints and dragon burger bars. Chapter 22. The night in Islington was sweet and fragrant. There were, of course, no full-honest fire dragons about in the alley, but if any had chanced by, they might just as well have sloped off across the road for a pizza, for they were not going to be needed. Had an emergency cropped up while they were still in the middle of their American hots with extra anchovy, they could always have sent across a message to put dire straits on the stereo, which is now known to have much the same effect. No, said Fenchurch, not yet. Arthur put dire straits on the stereo. Fenchurch pushed ajar the upstairs front door to let in a little more of the sweet, fragrant night air. They both sat on some of the furniture made out of cushions, very close to the open bottle of champagne. No, said Fenchurch, not till you found out what's wrong with me, which bit. But I suppose, she added, very, very quietly, that we may as well start with where your hand is now. Arthur said, so which way do I go? Down, said Fenchurch on this occasion. He moved his hand. Down, she said, is in fact the other way. Oh, yes. Mark Knopfler has an extraordinary ability to make a Schecter Custom Stratocaster hoot and sing like angels on a Saturday night, exhausted from being good all week and needing a stiff beer, which is not strictly relevant at this point since the record hadn't yet got to that bit, but there will be too much else going on when it does, and furthermore the chronicler does not intend to sit here with a track list and a stopwatch, so it seems best to mention it now while things are still moving slowly. And so we come, said Arthur, to your knee. There is something terribly and tragically wrong with your left knee. My left knee, said Fenchurch, is absolutely fine. So it is, said Arthur. Did you know that... What? It's all right. I can tell you do. No, keep going. So it has to be something to do with your feet? She smiled in the dim light and wriggled her shoulders non-committally against the cushions. Since there are cushions in the universe, on Squanchulus Beta, to be exact, two worlds in from the swampland of the mattresses, that actively enjoy being wriggled against, particularly if it's non-committally because of the syncopated way in which the shoulders move, it's a pity they weren't there. They weren't, but such is life. Arthur held her left foot in his lap and looked it over carefully. All kinds of stuff about the way her dress fell away from her legs was making it difficult for him to think particularly clearly at this point. I have to admit, he said, that I really don't know what I'm looking for. You'll know when you find it, she said. Really, you will. There was a slight catch in her voice. It's not that one. Feeling increasingly puzzled, Arthur let her left foot down onto the floor and moved himself around so that he could take her right foot. She moved forward, put her arms round and kissed him, because the record got to that bit which, if you knew the record, you would know made it impossible not to do this. She gave him her right foot. He stroked it, ran his fingers round her ankle, under her toes, along her instep, could find nothing wrong with it. She watched him with great amusement, laughed and shook her head. No, don't stop, she said, but it's not that one now. Arthur stopped and frowned at her left foot on the floor. Don't stop. He stroked her right foot, ran his fingers round her ankle, under her toes, along her instep, and said, you mean it's something to do with which leg I'm holding? She did another of the shrugs which would have brought such joy into the life of a simple cushion from Squanchulus Beta. He frowned. Pick me up, she said quietly. He let her right foot down to the floor and stood up. So did she. He picked her up in his arms and they kissed again. This went on for a while, and then she said, now put me down again. Still puzzled, he did so. Well? She looked at him almost challengingly. So what's wrong with my feet? She said. Arthur still did not understand. He sat on the floor, then got down on his hands and knees to look at her feet, in situ, as it were, in their normal habitat. And as he looked closely, something odd struck him. He put his head right down to the ground and peered. There was a long pause. He sat back heavily. "Yes," he said, "I see what's wrong with your feet. They don't touch the ground." "So," she said, "what do you think?" Arthur looked up quickly and saw the deep apprehension making her eyes suddenly dark. She bit her lip and was trembling. "What do," she stammered, "are you..." She shook the hair forward over her eyes that were filling with dark, fearful tears. He stood up quickly, put his arms around her, and gave her a single kiss. "Perhaps you can do what I can do," he said, and walked straight out of her upstairs front door. The record got to the good bit. Chapter 23. The battle raged on about the Star of Zaxis. Hundreds of the fierce and horribly beweaponed Zerzler ships had now been smashed and wrenched to atoms by the withering forces the huge silver Xaxician ship was able to deploy. Part of the moon had gone too, blasted away by the same blazing force guns that ripped the very fabric of space as they passed through it. The Zerzler ships that remained, horribly beweaponed though they were now hopelessly outclassed by the devastating power of the Zaxician ship, and were fleeing for cover behind the rapidly disintegrating moon, when the Zaxician ship, in hurtling pursuit behind them, suddenly announced that it needed a holiday, and left the field of battle. All was redoubled fear and consternation for a moment, but the ship was gone. With the stupendous powers at its command, it flitted across vast tracts of irrationally shaped space, quickly, effortlessly, and above all, quietly. Deep in his greasy, smelly bunk, fashioned out of a maintenance hatchway, Ford Prefect slept among his towels, dreaming of old haunts. He dreamed at one point of his slumbers in New York. In his dream, he was walking late at night along the east side, beside the river which had become so extravagantly polluted that new life forms are now emerging from it spontaneously, demanding welfare and voting rights. One of these now floated past, waving. Ford waved back. The thing thrashed to the shore and struggled up the bank. Hi, it said. I've just been created. I'm completely new to the universe in all respects. Is there anything you can tell me? Phew, said Ford, a little nonplussed. I can tell you where some bars are, I guess. What about love and happiness? I sense deep needs for things like that, it said, waving its tentacles. Got any leads there? You can get something like what you require, said Ford, on 7th Avenue. I instinctively feel, said the creature urgently, that I need to be beautiful, am I? You're pretty direct, aren't you? Well, no point in mucking about. Now, am I? The thing was oozing all over the place now, squelching and blubbering. A nearby wino was getting interested. To me, said Ford, no. But listen, he added after a moment, most people make out, you know. Are there any like you down there?
Search me, Buster, said the creature. As I said, I'm new here. Life is entirely strange to me. What's it like?
Here was something that Ford felt he could speak about with authority. Life, he said, is like a grapefruit.
How so?
Well, it's sort of orangey-yellow and dimpled on the outside, wet and squidgy in the middle. It's got pips inside, too. Oh, and some people have half a one for breakfast.
Is there anyone else out there I can talk to?
I expect so, said Ford. Ask a policeman.
Deep in his bunk, Ford Prefect wriggled and turned onto his other side. It wasn't his favourite type of dream, because it didn't have eccentric Galumbitz, the triple-breasted whore of Eroticon 6 in it, whom many of his dreams did feature, but at least it was a dream. At least he was asleep.
End of side 6.